Fitzgerald in June. And those two accidents killed 17 sailors. And all of this has led to the removal of the fleet's commander, as well as seven other top brass. Crew members in the fleet have publicly complained about being overworked, dysfunction in the ranks, and low morale. And keep in mind here that this is the fleet that has been called on to respond to the threats in the past year coming out of North Korea. So it has been a very stressful year.
NPR's Rob Schmitz. Thank you so much, Rob.
Thanks, Noel.
These are busy times in Washington. Congress is going to reconvene on Monday amid many stories of sexual harassment. Republicans are rushing to rewrite the tax code before the new year, and President Trump is going to be pushing them to get that done. Meanwhile, a special counsel is investigating the president's ties to Russia, and just this morning there is some news on that story. We're going to talk all this through with Jeff Bennett. He's NBC's White House correspondent. He's here with us in studio. Hey, Jeff, thanks for coming in.
Sure thing. Good morning.
All right. So numerous outlets this morning, Jeff, reporting that President Trump's former national security advisor, Michael Flynn, may be distancing himself from the White House in this Russia investigation. Tell us what's going on.
That's right. Well, we know Michael Flynn's legal team has informed President Trump's legal team that they will no longer share information as it relates to special counsel Robert Mueller's investigation. And so we know legal experts say that defense teams often share information and materials that they have in common while advocating for separate clients. This revelation doesn't prove that Mike Flynn is now cooperating with the special counsel investigation, but it's the clearest indication yet that he might be.
No. And what would that mean for President Trump's lawyers?
Well, the question I think that we should talk about is what it means for Robert Mueller, because yeah. What it does really is it gives Robert Mueller a behind-the-scenes look at the campaign, at the transition, and at the early days of the Trump administration, because Mike Flynn, as you know, was there for all of it. He was the central figure in President Trump's national security team. He only served for 24 days, of course. But if he is cooperating, we have to say, of course, at this point, it's speculation. We don't know for sure that he is. But if he is, he has a lot of information that he could share with the special counsel.
And have we gotten any evidence from the White House this morning, or have we gotten any, whisperings from the White House this morning that President Trump's lawyers might actually be worried about this turn of events?
Jay Sekulow, who is one of President Trump's attorneys, says that we should not read too much into this. But, you know, as I said before, Mike Flynn was a central figure very close to the Trump campaign. And President Trump was asked about Mike Flynn just 2 days after he resigned back in February. Take a listen to what he had to say.
General Flynn is a wonderful man. I think he's been treated very, very unfairly by the media.
Treated very unfairly by the media. One wonders what President Trump has to say about General Mike Flynn at this point.
Yeah, yeah. Well, another politician making news, obviously, is Roy Moore, the Republican candidate for Senate in the Alabama race, accused of sexual misconduct with mm-hmm. teenagers. We only have a couple weeks left in this race. Can we make any predictions there?
Oh, I got out of the prediction business November 8th, 2016. But we do know President Trump's wondered aloud before he left for Mar-a-Lago. The question was, you know, will you go campaign for Roy Moore there in Alabama? And he said, we'll see. I'll let you know next week. I talked to some Trump staffers about that. They're not even entirely sure if the president will actually go to Alabama and campaign alongside Roy Moore. Talking to some Roy Moore supporters in Alabama, they say it doesn't even much matter at this point because they already view that implicit endorsement from President Trump on the South Lawn as an endorsement in and of itself. He gave Republicans cover to support Roy Moore in the sense that he said it's important to have a Republican hold that Senate seat for all the great many things that President Trump wants to accomplish. At the top of that list right now, of course, is tax overhaul.
Tax overhaul, right. Congress goes back to work on Monday. I assume that's at the top of their agenda?
Yeah, that's right. They're actually the big four, as they're known. McConnell, Paul Ryan, Nancy Pelosi, Chuck Schumer, they're all set to meet with President Trump at the White House on Tuesday to talk about tax reform and the end-of-year legislative agenda items. So there's a must-do list for Congress, and there's a like-to-do list for Congress as they come back to Washington and look to the end of the year. Taxes is at the very top of the would-like-to-do list. The thing they have to do is pass some sort of government funding measure ahead of a December 8th deadline to keep the government running. And Democrats want to tie to that bill protections for Dreamers, the DACA protections that President Trump ended some months ago. They want to codify into law the protections for the roughly 800,000 young people who came to the country illegally.
I know you said you're out of the prediction business, but do you think Congress is going to get some meaningful work done now, between now and the end of the year?
Well, you know, it's interesting about this. Republicans say on the record that they have to do something on taxes. I think Lindsey Graham said it best, not just because the Republican base wants to see something done on taxes, but the donors also want to see Republicans do something, have something to show for their control of all the levers of power here in Washington.
Something does need to get done. NBC's White House correspondent Jeff Bennett, thank you so much.
Sure thing.
This is the day that businesses call Black Friday, the day after Thanksgiving. For those who wonder, one of the stories of why it's called Black Friday is that it's a big shopping day when retailers traditionally made enough money to be sure they were profitable for the year, in the black. That's one of the stories, anyway. In recent years, Black Friday inspired the opt-out movement, persuading people to skip Black Friday shopping and do something else. Now, some state and national parks are taking part in the opt-outside movement. They want people to go for a hike. Emily Russell of Alaska Public Media reports from Chugach State Park in Anchorage.
Walking through mostly birch forest. It snowed a couple days ago, so there's some fresh snow on the ground and on the trees. It's wild, it's wintry, and for Black Friday, the $5 parking fee in Chugach State Park is waived. In 2015, the outdoor gear company REI shut its doors on Black Friday and unveiled the Opt Outside campaign. Carrie Harris stopped into REI here in Anchorage the day before Thanksgiving.
Right now, I am shopping for a hat for myself.
Harris says she's glad REI is closed on Black Friday. After a late breakfast that she says will probably include some turkey, Harris and her family plan to steer clear of the shops today.
Well, my in-laws are in town, and with our three little boys, we're going to get out and do some sledding and try to stay away from downtown, all of civilization here in Anchorage, and just spend time together as a family outside.
They can do that at any state park in Alaska for free today. Ethan Tyler is the director of the state's Office of Parks and Recreation.
We're certainly encouraging people to use the hashtag #OptOutside. And as part of that, we are waiving all of our parking fees.
And others are doing the same, from Mount Ascutney State Park in Vermont to Mount Rainier National Park in Washington. If you do opt outside, you might miss out on some bargains at the store, but the payoff can be huge.
Just walked around this corner and I'm now in this big bowl surrounded by mountains on three sides, and right now I see two moose, and they've stopped moving right now. I think they see me, or at least they hear me. Really just spectacular.
For NPR News, I'm Emily Russell in Anchorage.
This is NPR News.
Good morning. It is 8:18. You're listening to Wisconsin Public Radio. NPR headlines are coming up next, and then during the WPR newscast, the state's unemployment figures have rebounded since the Great Recession, but the number of people seeking help from food pantries hasn't followed. We'll take a closer look coming up in about 15 minutes.
Support for WGTD comes from Carthage College, providing graduate and accelerated certification programs in education to start or advance a career in teaching. More information is available online at carthage.edu/grad.
CHS.us. WPR is proud to promote enriching and engaging communities. More information at rchs.us.
From NPR News in Washington, I'm Dave Mattingly. State media in Cairo say the death toll is up to 184 after today's terror attack targeting a mosque in the northern Sinai Peninsula. Relatives of those aboard a missing Argentine Navy submarine are fearing the worst 9 days after contact was lost in the Atlantic. NPR's Philip Reeves says the sub had a weak supply of oxygen.
The mood in Argentina appears to be changing. Hope is being replaced by grief and anger. Some of the relatives of the 44 crew on board the sub are accusing the authorities of sending the submariners to sea in an old vessel in poor repair and also of withholding information.
The U.S. Navy says it's ending the search for three sailors missing in Wednesday's crash of a military transport plane in the waters off Japan. The legal team representing President Trump's former national security advisor, Michael Flynn, is no longer communicating with the president's lawyers. NBC's White House correspondent Jeff Bennett spoke to NPR's Morning Edition about the possible implications.
Defense teams, when there are these sort of complex investigations, do often share information, do often collaborate. The revelation that Mike Flynn's team has informed President Trump's team that they'll no longer work together doesn't prove that, Mike Flynn will now work with Robert Mueller, but it is the clearest indication yet that he might.
Mueller is the special counsel leading the probe into Russian interference in last year's U.S. presidential race. I'm Dave Mattingly in Washington.
This is Wisconsin Public Radio News at 8:20. I'm Rachel Vasquez. Many people have spent time celebrating the Thanksgiving holiday this week over all the fixings, but thousands of people across the state are struggling to put food on the table. Shay Morris with Second Harvest Northern Lakes Food Bank says just under 18,000 people were using food shelves each month across northern Minnesota and Wisconsin during the height of the recession. Despite declining unemployment rates, Morris says that those numbers haven't returned to pre-recession levels.
That number hovered around 12,000 a month. I think the 41 food shelves that we serve are serving almost 16,000 people a month on average.
Morris says seniors on fixed incomes tend to visit food shelves when heating costs rise during the winter months. Around 600,000 people in Wisconsin seek services from five food banks and their partners each year, according to the most recent hunger study from Feeding America. Milwaukee police say officials have arrested a person of interest in a series of sexual assaults that occurred this week. The Milwaukee Police Department said yesterday that the investigation is still active and ongoing. Authorities say the assaults happened earlier this week. The department says officials plan to send the case to the district attorney's office in the coming days. WITI-TV reports that the sexual assaults took place along Milwaukee's lakefront. You're listening to Wisconsin Public Radio News. I'm Rachel Vasquez.
Support for NPR comes from this station and from Right at Home, working to improve the quality of life for seniors and people with disabilities by providing services like health monitoring and personal care. The right care, right at home. More at rightathome.net/NPR. From the Herbert Simon Family Foundation, supporting NPR and member station WFYI in Indianapolis, working together to cover stories and issues that inform listeners in Indiana and beyond by providing critical information about the factors influencing education. And from A24, presenting Lady Bird, starring Saoirse Ronan and Laurie Metcalf, in a mother-daughter comedy about the relationships that shape us, the beliefs that define us, and the unmatched beauty of a place called home. Lady Bird, now playing in select cities.
It's Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Noelle King.
And I'm Steve Inskeep. Good morning. Picture a map of North and South America. The two continents together have one incredibly long Pacific coast. So they share an ocean and an interconnected chain of mountains. Similar landscapes, similar climates in some places, and similar news stories. Last month, wildfires spread across California wine country. NPR's Philip Reeves found a strikingly similar tale far down the coast.
If you think there's nowhere on Earth like California, you might want to reconsider. There is a place 5,000 miles due south. This is it. Chile sits on South America's western edge. Like California, it's a long, thin slither of land between the mountains and the sea. Like California, that quirk of geography allows Chile to produce world-class wines. Add to the list earthquakes, deserts, and a couple of gold rushes. And these two places seem similar. There's something else. We're in the hills of Patoka in central Chile. This is part of a big chunk of Chile that recently suffered a severe 7-year drought. Ana Varas lives here with three young kids in one of a cluster of ramshackle homes near a river. The river provided water for a local gold mine where her husband worked. The drought reduced the river to a trickle. The mine closed. Her husband's moved away to find a job, returning home only at weekends. Varas plans to move the family out. A place without water has no future, she says. In January, Chile was hit by an extreme heat wave, followed by the worst wildfires in the country's history.
sunset were like purple, you know, with all the smog.
Maisa Rocas is a climatologist at the University of Chile.
I remember taking a plane from the south of Santiago and I would look out of the window and it was just smoke and smoke and smoke. Really terrifying.
The fires destroyed forests and farmland and even small towns. 2,300 square miles were burnt. Like California, it happened in wine country.
We got, you know, some fires there between these mountains. These mountains totally burned, you know.
The mountain right there in front of us, the hill right there was
burned. Just in front of us.
Gerardo Leal is viticulture manager for the Santa Rita Estates, one of Chile's top winemakers. The fires reached the edge of this Santa Rita vineyard near Chile's capital, Santiago. Leal also saw them from the air.
I was flying by helicopters, you know, and controlling with water, you know. I was in one helicopter, but not controlling, you know, and just looking for the strategy, just looking for specific points to control, you know, in a best way.
The fires were a huge shock to Chileans who wanted to know why they happened. Maisa Rojas, the climatologist, says the wildfires can't be blamed on one single factor.
Lots of things explain why these fires occur, but the drought and high temperatures is, of course, fuel for this to happen.
Rojas says Chile has been going through some extreme climatic conditions recently. Chile's government directly attributes these to climate change.
And we are using here, if you see here, we're using this kind of metal post.
The effects of that are felt here, you know, in the vineyard, says Gerardo Leal. New vines are being grown in different positions to give grapes more shade. Because in this part of Chile these days, the ripening season's hotter and sunlight's more intense.
Do you believe that is because of climate change?
Absolutely.
No doubt in your mind?
No doubt. No doubt.
But some people do doubt.
Yes, I know.
Santa Rita and other Chilean winemakers have begun establishing vineyards in the cooler, wetter south of Chile. In the end, this vineyard was saved from the January fires. Just a few vines were burned, says Leal, though lots of grapes were damaged by smoke.
We were lucky.
That's the kind of luck many Californians could have done with. Philip Reeves, NPR News.
The film Call Me By Your Name is a coming-of-age story set in the early 1980s about two young American men who fall in love one summer in Italy.
I can show you around.
That'd be great. Thank you. So what do you do around here?
Read books, transcribe music, swim at the river, go out at night.
Sounds fun. All right, later.
A graduate student, played by the actor Armie Hammer, falls for his professor's teenage son. April Wolf is lead film critic at LA Weekly, and she joins us from NPR West. Hey, April.
Hi there. Hi, Noelle.
Critics really love this movie, including you, yes. Judging by your review. What is the big deal?
This film does romance and a recreation of falling in love so well that I couldn't help but fall for it. One of the things that I love is this dialogue back and forth of these two men who they tease one another. Hmm. And it's sweet. It feels almost as though we can see their brains kind of sinking in the same way that their bodies are. And to me, that's real love. And a lot of directors, they don't quite know how to portray that on screen.
There is an interesting age difference between the two young men who fall in love. Oliver, the graduate student, is 24. Mm-hmm. The boy who falls in love with him is 17. What do you think, given the times we're in?
You know, I was uneasy with this for a moment, but it feels like it's presented very differently because it is set in Italy. The age of consent there is 14, and they seem to treat these teenagers as adults who are making their own decisions, who are on their own. It is, from an American lens, it is still a little bit uneasy for me. But at the same time, these two characters, they are both very intelligent. And sometimes the idea of age would just kind of vanish from my head as I was watching it.
So this is a movie that brings to mind some other love stories, like last year's Moonlight or Brokeback Mountain, for example. How does this film feel different from those?
Honestly, I have to say this one feels more like a classic film. Luca Guadagnino, the director, is so good at directing not just what you see and hear, but how you feel things, how you smell things. The whole orchard that these characters live in, you know, you feel as though you can smell these peaches and stone fruits that are growing on the property.
Oh, it sounds extraordinary. April Wolf is lead film critic at LA Weekly. April, thanks for coming in.
Thank you so much.
This is NPR News.
Because you know you're about ready to get locked up, don't you?
What can you learn from decades of reporting on the criminal justice system? Our own Robert Siegel tells us.
We're flawed. We're capable of error. And those stories certainly always left me with that lesson.
I'm Ari Shapiro, looking back on what has changed and what hasn't in American crime and punishment this afternoon on All Things Considered from NPR News.
You can hear All Things Considered from 4 to 6:30 today with WPR's Brady Carlson here on WPR.
You're listening to WGTD HD, Kenosha, Racine, Elkhorn, and Lake Geneva, NPR News and Classical Music.
You're listening to Morning Edition on WPR. Wisconsin Life is coming up in about 15 minutes. Today we'll hear about one man's experience with a buck during deer hunting season. Good morning. It is 8:30. I'm Rachel Vasquez in for Maureen McCollum. In Wisconsin news, about 10 protesters spent the day before Thanksgiving urging House Speaker Paul Ryan to pass what they call a Clean Dream Act. They held signs near Ryan's Janesville office, and they shared stories of immigrant families who they say would be broken up if Congress does not pass a new Deferred Action for Childhood Arrivals program. The program, known as DACA, prevents deportation for people brought to the U.S. illegally as children. President Donald Trump wants to eliminate the program, but he's giving Congress time to pass a revised version. Students from the group Voces de la Frontera organized a protest, along with the group Youth Empowered in the Struggle. The Green Bay Packers say a winter jubilee celebration is set to start soon at the Titletown District near Lambeau Field. The celebration's first day is next Thursday. It will include the debut of Titletown's ice skating rink, the grand opening of a bistro and event space, and the inaugural winter jubilee light show. You're listening to WPR News.
Support for Wisconsin Public Radio comes from Luther College in Decorah, Iowa, where an average of 97% of graduates go on to employment, further schooling, or volunteer service within 8 months. Information is at luther.edu.
The Gateway Radio Reading Service is for visually impaired listeners who'd like to have local newspapers and books read to them. In the Kenosha Racine area, specially tuned, easy to operate radios are available free of charge. Visit WGTD.org or dial 564-3870.
It'll be a mostly cloudy day across northern Wisconsin with rain showers developing throughout the day. Partly cloudy in southern Wisconsin and unseasonably warm temperatures with very windy and dry conditions in the southern half of the state. Highs will be in the low to mid 40s in northern Wisconsin and climbing up to the mid to high 50s in the south.
Support for NPR comes from this station and from 23andMe, a personalized genetic service dedicated to helping people learn what their 23 pairs of chromosomes say about their health, traits, and ancestry. Learn more at 23andMe.com. From Cigna, a global health service company dedicated to helping people improve their health, well-being, and sense of security. More information is available at Cigna.com. And from the John S. and James L. Knight Foundation, helping NPR advance journalistic excellence in the digital age.
This is Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Noel King.
And I'm Steve Inskeep. Good morning. President Trump is getting on the phone today with his Turkish counterpart, President Recep Tayyip Erdogan. This call comes at a difficult moment diplomatically between the United States and Turkey, which is a key NATO ally, although Turkey's foreign minister is insisting this week that the alliance remains strong. NPR's Peter Kenyon has covered this story for years. He's based in Istanbul. Hi, Peter.
Hi, Steve.
You know, I think if you have to say things are good, sometimes it's an indication they're not.
Yeah, exactly. And I've been talking to a lot of folks recently, diplomats, politicians, ordinary Turks on the street, analysts, and all the answers I'm getting are negative. It's bad. It's getting worse. Why isn't it being turned around? I talked to one analyst, Sinan Ulgun. He heads a think tank here in Istanbul, and he says this doesn't feel quite the same as the past crises that they've had, and there have been a few over the decades. But this, he says, is a little bit different. Here's how he put it.
The relationship is indeed very bad. There's a very significant erosion of trust, which we really haven't witnessed in this relationship over the past many decades.
Now, what he's talking about is this rising anti-American sentiment in Turkey. You hear it all the time. It's quite regular for people on the street to say, yes, of course, America was involved in this coup. We had attempted coup last year.
Conspiracy theory, okay.
Yeah, well, exactly. And possibly even the CIA was involved. All kinds of stories you can hear. And the reason, the U.S. denies it, of course, but the people here say, why else would you not give us back this cleric, Fethullah Gulen, who Turkey says was behind the coup? And then you look at it from the other perspective. If Washington looks at Turkey, it sees state of emergency still ongoing, tens of thousands arrested, a lot of people sacked from their jobs. They watch Turkey buying Russian missiles instead of from a NATO country, storming out of recent NATO exercises. There's also a lot of anger here in Turkey over trials going on in the U.S., including one about alleged evasion of Iran sanctions.
Okay, so what is that? What are these trials you're describing?
Well, this one in particular, it's known here as the Gold for Oil scheme. Turkey allegedly made payments for petroleum products to Iran, but disguised them so as to avoid U.S. sanctions on doing business with Tehran. Now, the reason it's a big deal here is because similar charges came up in 2013 at the time when President Recep Tayyip Erdogan and this cleric, Fethullah Gulen, had their big split. There was an explosive anti-corruption probe alleging graft at the highest levels of government. Some of those same claims are going likely to appear in this trial. And there's fear here that possible wiretap evidence could be used, including maybe the voices of senior officials. So there's a lot of nervousness here.
You know, Peter, as you're talking, I'm thinking about U.S. relations with another country, Pakistan, where the two sides sometimes are furious at each other, almost seem to hate each other, and there are news events that make things worse from time to time. But in the end, they decide they have an interest in cooperating on some level. Does Turkey still see its interests in such a way that, the interest would dictate that it stick with the West and stick with the U.S., even if they're not happy about it?
On occasion, as these latest comments from the foreign minister suggest, they do again sing that tune that the relationship is too important to break, it's not beyond repair. But there's a lot more urgency now about the need to get things turned around now. And everything we're seeing so far suggests just the opposite. Turkey's moving towards Russia, especially on Syria. And there's strong-willed leaders who may not be in a conciliatory mood. So what happens will remain to be seen.
Peter, thanks very much.
Thanks, Steve.
And NPR's Peter Kenyon.
NASA has high hopes for virtual reality and wants to use VR for everything, from geological research to fixing satellites. And to that end, they are tapping some new talent, high school students. NPR's Rebecca Hersher has a story.
Jackson Ames is a senior in Maryland, and one of his hobbies is video games.
A lot of games that involve strategy and teamwork. One of my favorite ones is something called Onward.
Onward is a virtual reality war game. It's supposed to make players feel like they're soldiers fighting a battle. You play with a headset, headphones, a controller in each hand, and everything about it is hyper-realistic.
Yeah, it's much more realistic than anything else. It adds a whole new layer.
Ames is 17. He feels totally at home with virtual reality technology. He can't even remember a time when he didn't use computers. Armed with his love of VR and some actual coding skills from high school classes, Ames landed an internship over the summer at NASA's Goddard Space Flight Center. And the guy who hired him is a NASA engineer named Thomas Grubb. Grubb used to play video games as a teenager back in the 80s, but there's just no time for that anymore. And he was really just looking for basic, cheap labor to help out on some virtual reality projects.
I went into this with like, okay, I'll take a couple interns or whatever.
He thought he'd get a college student to help out with debugging and stuff. But when he posted the job,
I got all these amazing students coming back, and I was like, I want more than this. I ended up with five.
And they were super valuable because they understand what works and what doesn't in the virtual world. NASA has some pretty big ambitions for what it wants to do with VR. Repair technicians in VR headsets on Earth, fixing orbiting satellites in real time. scientists exploring remote locations from their offices, like the inside of an ancient volcano. That's the program that I tried.
Yeah. All right, so let's put, and it should fit snugly without being too tight.
I'm a little nervous about it.
I think you'll be okay, but there was
now,
definitely
I'm
some
28.
Older...
I'm not a technological dinosaur, at least not yet.
Here we go.
But honestly, I found the virtual lava tube highly alarming. At first, I felt like I couldn't move at all.
No, no, no. Wow.
Then, when I finally did, I was just bumbling around in this virtual cave.
Here we are, inside. Rocks of the lava tube, the sky above.
The real cave is in Idaho. The virtual gray rocks look pixelated, but you still get dizzy looking up. The lava tube is really tall. I can kneel down and virtually measure boulders, at least theoretically, if I can get my body to move right.
This is a little weird.
Ugh, how do gamers do it? When I ask Jackson Ames about it, he can barely cover up his impatience.
Well, it's just, I think that it's the future. Because we've been stuck with using 2D screens for 30 years or something like that.
And Grubb agrees. He thinks even if the technology has a learning curve, VR can definitely be helpful for research.
You know, it's cheaper to have people go to a lava tube in VR than to actually fly them out there for 2 weeks and everything else. All of these things can save a lot of money or time or just enable new things.
In a few years, he hopes even the most seasoned NASA scientists will be strapping on virtual reality headsets at work. Rebecca Hersher, NPR News.
This is NPR News.
Good morning. It is 8:41. Thanks for being with us on this Friday morning. You're listening to Morning Edition on Wisconsin Public Radio. News headlines from NPR are next. And then in the WPR newscast, rural schools were looking for increased funding as part of a recent measure in front of the legislature. WPR's Hope Kerwin has more coming up in just a few minutes.
When you make a gift of $100 a month to Wisconsin Public Radio, you're not only making a decision to support your values, you're also making a commitment that helps keep WPR strong today and for years to come. Because you can't imagine your day without WPR, consider a gift of $100 a month to support your favorite station. Your gift will have significant impact. To make your gift, go to WPR.org and click Donate. Thank you.
From NPR News in Washington, I'm Dave Mattingly. Islamic State is suspected of carrying out today's deadly attack on a mosque in Egypt. State media in Cairo say at least 184 people were killed, dozens more wounded. The attack began with an explosion followed by gunfire. NPR's Jane Araf says the mosque is in the northern Sinai Peninsula, where Egyptian security forces have been battling an ISIS insurgency.
The mosque was full of worshipers who were holding Friday prayers. It's the traditional day where people congregate at the mosque. And the attackers apparently not only set off the explosives, they opened fire on the worshipers, which explains part of that extremely high death toll that we're seeing.
So far, no group has claimed responsibility. Zimbabwe has a new president today. NPR's Afebia Quistarkton was at the swearing-in ceremony at the National Stadium in Harare.
Emmerson Mnangagwa has taken the oath of office and has taken over from former President Mugabe. I'm at the National Stadium, which is absolutely jam-packed, capacity 60,000, and it is very nearly full.
Mnangagwa is promising democratic elections next year. Robert Mugabe ruled Zimbabwe for 37 years. He resigned this week amid impeachment proceedings days after the military took over. I'm Dave Mattingly in Washington.
This is Wisconsin Public Radio News at 8:43. I'm Rachel Vasquez. The state legislature passed a number of bills this month before going on break, but one issue that did not see any action is sparsity aid for public schools. Hope Kerwin has more on why rural school districts were hoping for more funding through the program.
Speaker Robin Voss told Wispolitics the Assembly won't consider an increase to sparsity aid when the session resumes next year. Rural schools use the funds to offset additional costs, like bus buses traveling more miles and less access to mental health services. And Kickapoo Area District Administrator Doug Olson says rural districts are at a disadvantage without it.
These are things that impact small schools in a very, very large way. And so, you know, I don't know if there's a fair way to distribute this money. I just know what the needs of rural schools are, and the sparsity aid is definitely a help.
But Olson says the program has also been controversial among rural districts, with some sparsely populated schools not qualifying because they have too many students. Hope Kerwin, Wisconsin Public Radio.
A Wisconsin lawmaker is among three people interested in the Green Bay mayor's post now that incumbent Jim Schmidt plans to step down. That's according to the Green Bay Press Gazette. Democratic State Representative Eric Genrich says he's interested in running, along with Alderman Tom DeWayne and Brown County Board Member Pat Evans. Earlier this week, Schmidt said he would complete his fourth and current term. You're listening to WPR News.
Support for NPR comes from this station and from the William and Flora Hewlett Foundation, committed to supporting ideas and institutions to advance education for all, preserve the environment, and promote vibrant performing arts. More information is available at hewlett.org. From Cancer Treatment Centers of America, which publishes treatment results for 11 types of cancer, including quality of life ratings, to help patients and their caregivers make informed choices about their care. Learn more at cancercenter.com. And from the Annie E. Casey Foundation.
This is Morning Edition on Wisconsin Public Radio, and now it's time for Wisconsin Life. Here's executive producer Erica Janik.
Hunting is about many things: tradition, family, nature. For Ron Weber, an experience with a buck left a lasting mark on his hunting season.
Snow was gently falling as I moved through the dark woods towards a tree stand on a balsam ridge near the edge of an expanse of spruce fog. The excitement of the impending hunt wasn't the only reason I could feel my heart racing. Walking alone conjures up childhood visions of creatures of the night on the prowl, though many may not admit it. A pack of coyotes broke the silence, their excited yipping confirming that I was not the only hunter on the move. With the gathering light, shapes and eventually images became visible. 2 inches of fresh snow covered the forest floor. I felt as though something memorable could happen this day. The first few hours were uneventful, save for the regular visits of some of the neighboring red squirrels and blue jays. Looking down the ridge, I saw a shape that seemed out of place. I noticed a quick flash of white. With the flick of its tail, the deer, which carried a small rack, began to walk across the ridge and down towards the bog. A couple of grunts from my grunt call stopped the buck's descent. He turned and began walking towards me. I raised my bow and got into position as the buck closed the distance. At 15 yards, his head went behind a large maple, and I came to full draw. Concentrating on his chest, I instinctively lined the bow up with my target. My fingers released the string, and in an instant, the arrow disappeared into the buck's chest with a thud. The deer bolted forward about 20 yards and stopped. He began to walk off as if nothing was wrong, and for a moment I wondered if I had hit him. His tail flicked wildly, and his legs began to quiver. He lowered his front legs and brought his rump down, as if bedding down for the night. 30 seconds later, he lay on his side and never moved again. I sat back to say a prayer. A red squirrel ran down the limb above me, and a chickadee noisily hopped from one branch to the next. Everything seemed the same as it was 5 minutes earlier, but something inside me felt very different. Walking the short distance to my buck, I noticed large splashes of crimson in the snow. My eyes met the blank gaze in his soft brown eyes. My legs began to tremble. As I knelt beside the deer, tears welled up and began streaming down my face. It's been 5 years now since that November day. I've not filled a tag since, but not for lack of opportunity. I still love every part of the hunting experience, except the killing. In Jack and Diane, John Cougar Mellencamp sang about life. But for me, the hunt goes on long after the thrill of killing has gone. The trail we're on as hunters leads us into many places we never expected to be. Maybe I will pass through this phase, Or maybe I will continue to hunt by the mantra that author James Kerwood suggested when he wrote, "The greatest thrill is not to kill, but to let live." Next season, as another buck walks past me down the ridge on a steely cold November day, my bow with arrow nocked will remain resting on my lap. With that, I'm at total peace. That may be the lasting legacy of the buck and the balsams.
Ron Weber is a forester in Weyerhaeuser. Wisconsin Life is a co-production of Wisconsin Public Radio and Wisconsin Public Television in partnership with the Wisconsin Humanities Council. Additional support comes from Lowell and Mary Peterson of Appleton. Find more Wisconsin Life on our website, wisconsinlife.org, and on Facebook. I'm Erica Janik.
It is 10 minutes before 9 o'clock, and classical music starts in 15 minutes here on WPR. But still to come on Morning Edition, we talk with Icelandic musician Björk about her new album, Utopia, which features a 12-piece female flute orchestra. NPR's Rachel Martin sits down with the musician coming up in a few minutes.
Tune into Wisconsin Public Television Monday night at 7 for Our House, the Wisconsin Capitol. Join host Michael Bridgman for this portrait of Wisconsin's architectural crown jewel, the state capitol. As we celebrate the 100th anniversary of the building's completion, discover the many reasons it has become the people's house. Our House, the Wisconsin Capitol, premieres Monday at 7 on Wisconsin Public Television.
Highs today will be in the 40s and 50s. This is WPR.
Support for Wisconsin Public Radio comes from the Earl M. Terry Endowment Fund, a permanent endowment that provides ongoing support to sustain the present and future operation of Wisconsin Public Radio.
WGTD is on your smartphone. For local news and the rest of the mobile version of our website, log on to WGTD.org. For live audio streams of WGTD, 24/7 Jazz HD2, and SportsWeb, visit the App Store and download the free WGTD app.
This is Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Noelle King.
And I'm Steve Inskeep. Have you felt like the last couple of years have been particularly heavy, hard, made you want to run away? Well, our co-host Rachel Martin sat down with the Icelandic musician Björk, whose new album is designed to take you somewhere you've never been so that you might be able to let some of the weight go.
Björk's music has always had this otherworldly quality to it. She's maybe the world's best-known avant-garde musician. This time around, the feeling of just jetting off to another planet is explicit. This time, Björk is searching for utopia.
Because the subject matter was utopia, I wanted to feel like you've entered this, come to this island, and there were all these sounds and birds and plants that you've never seen or heard before.
It is an interesting intellectual exercise to think about what utopia sounds like.
Yeah, I think so. We did a lot of research into like mythological stories from South America and Africa and from all over that had flutes in it. And they all seem to have that sort of same kind of story where all the women escape with the flutes and the children and they go to some place where there's no violence and no aggression and they form a new society that's utopian. But then always three quarters into the story, the males return.
The men ruin the utopia?
No, I think in the end, like first they come in some aggressive way, but then they have to kind of negotiate. The stories always end like on some sort of turn where the sexes have found a new way to communicate. So it has a happy ending. But I think the beginning of this album and the utopian idea is very much about escaping aggression and escaping as almost like a radical protest to say, okay, I'm gonna go with the children and my flutes over to that corner over there. And that's where I'm gonna define my utopia. And then once I've defined it, we can talk.
all there is.
Björk made her own radical departure after her last album. It was called Vulnikura, and it was about the pain of separating from her long-term partner. For the album Utopia, she assembled a 12-woman flute orchestra to create what Björk calls a sound that is light and fluffy, maybe. The flute, it is an instrument that you have worked with for a really long time. This was your first instrument growing up, am I right on that?
Yeah, I started playing the flute when I was like 5.
So many people learn the piano first, or maybe the violin, a string instrument. But when the flute, when that is the first instrument, I wonder if it has influenced how you compose music.
Yeah, definitely. I mean, I started writing melodies really young. I would always walk a lot outside, and I lived on the suburbs of Reykjavik, and that generation, we would walk in any weather, and I would sing a lot, and that would be like my friend, like how I would sort of cope with all the different weathers and the darkness. I think when you walk and sing at the same time, you know, you're probably regulating your breath. It's like a certain rhythm. And I still kind of, that's my most preferred way of singing still is walking. Not fast or anything, just like slowly, but, and actually very horizontally. I'm not much of a vertical hiker.
What is your go-to song when you're just walking around the city?
But I think most of the time when I'm singing, it's just more, I just make things up. I don't really sing other people's songs, or not even my old ones. I usually always try to walk somewhere where nobody can hear me. So I'm not really comfortable with people hearing. It was because I think for so long it was a secret of mine. So I think I'm probably quite good at hiding it.
I have to say, there's something funny about the idea of Björk walking around singing to herself and then being so embarrassed that you then stop when someone walks up. I mean, you are Björk. You're pretty good at singing.
But I'm not Björk to myself. I'm just, nobody is an icon to themselves.
But Björk is an icon to artists and fans around the world. So when she took to Facebook in October to describe sexual harassment she had faced, the world noticed. Björk says she did it to stand beside the growing number of people who are publicly naming their perpetrators.
All the women now that are coming out, they knew that if they would stand up, they would just be ridiculed. And what's so beautiful about this moment now is it's changing. And it's wonderful also for me to have a young daughter, and I feel just confident about that she's not going to have to take this on, you know? I think it's really feels like there's a big change in the air.
Do you think Utopia is possible? I mean, did you pick that title because you are inherently an optimist? Or is it a more cynical interpretation, casting it as a sort of naive expectation?
I think it's all of the above. I like the complexity that the title Utopia brings. I have 6 younger siblings. I was the oldest one, and then I had a child when I was a single mom very early. I've always had a lot of kids around me. And you know, when you are bringing up children, you have to have a plan, spiritual plan with optimism. There has to be a way out. And I feel I am a stubborn optimist in that way. But I don't think I'm unrealistic. I think with any situation, especially the tough ones, you have to have the imagination to think of an utopia. And then if only half of it, or even just a quarter of it, comes true, that's still plenty. That's still a lot. I can care for you,
care for you. The new album is called Utopia. We've been speaking with Björk. Thank you so much for talking with us.
Thank you. I care for
you, care for you. It's Morning Edition from NPR News. Our theme music was written by BJ Lederman, arranged by Jim Pugh. I'm Steve Inskeep.
And I'm Noel King.
And you can hear Morning Edition from 5 to 9 here on Wisconsin Public Radio. And to follow news throughout the day, visit WPR.org. There you can check out statewide reports from WPR's award-winning news team, plus national and global headlines from NPR. It's a minute before 9 o'clock. Stay with us. Headlines and music are coming up next.
Support for WPR comes from Bernie's Rock Shop, offering Moldavite, Larimar, and Amethyst designs in silver from worldwide artisans. 901 East Johnson Street in Madison. Expanded holiday hours and more are at Bernie's Facebook page.
Support comes from Kenosha Winter Harbor Market, featuring Angelic Bakehouse, offering non-GMO sprouted grain breads, including 7-grain, whole wheat, rye, and honey wheat with raisins. Flatbreads, wraps, and buns also available. The market is open Saturdays from 10 until 2 at the Rhodey.